of what we've already done and what we still are going to do. So I was given the impression that I could talk for a little while, and I think I'm going to do that. So probably about 40 minutes, I suppose. I'm not sure, I didn't time it. So. And as sort of background information, this is not one presentation, these are two presentations put together. So if they feel a bit incongruent at times, there's a good reason for that. So let me first of all say something about where I'm coming from. As Galina already said, I'm from Bielefeld University, and it's a rather new university, one of the German universities founded after the Second World War. It's actually, I think there's one thing that makes it very special, it's the building. The whole university is in one building. I think maybe it's nothing special here, but in Germany usually there tend to be, for the old universities, the buildings are spread all over town, which is the same here. And in Bielefeld it's one big, very ugly building that we're based in. The Faculty of Sociology at Bielefeld University is actually quite renowned one, especially for Niklas Luhmann, who was a part of the founding of the university. I'm not sure if Luhmann is such a big name here, but I think for sociologists, most would probably know him. So everyone knows he's known for his modern systems theory. What we're doing now is we have a collaborative research center. It has a very nice name, 882. So all the German research centers have some numbers, and this is ours. I'm not sure why we have this number, it's just a number. That started in July 2012. And it's an externally, a third-party funded research center with, I think, 15 or 20 projects, all about social inequality.
Sorry, it started this year in July?
No, 2011. Last year. First mistake, thanks. There are several projects dealing with social inequality within the nation state, and we're doing a project that I'm going to talk about conceptions of global inequality in world society. So this has a more of an international focus. Also, we haven't said we are political scientists, we're not sociologists. So sort of the odd man out in the whole thing. The team consists of Matthias Albert, who's the professor and sort of got the money for the project, Martin Koch and me, and since the two can't be here, unfortunately, I put the pictures on it. I know they're a bit strange, the pictures from the homepage, but so you have an impression. Matthias is actually the guy down there, and my colleague Martin is the other guy. Okay, I'm taking the class or have somebody else.
Just continue.
Basically sums it up. The idea of semantics is something that's very much embedded in the theory, especially the modern systems theory, where the people who designed the projects are coming from. I didn't design the project, I'm just doing it, and I'm still between the design and the real project. And for those who've ever done a project, they know that the design is often very much different from what you actually do in projects. So this is the stage in between. So we're not concerned with any proofs of global inequality or actually trying to find out about the materiality of global inequality, but the idea of how it's a discursively produced categories of semantics. The cases that we're studying is the World Bank and the United Nations Development Programme. They're both, I think, major development agencies, international organizations that are really concerned with the question of development. And also, since a couple of years, or maybe decades, with the question of global inequality. The project is very much based on this comparison between World Bank and United Nations Development Programme. So we're trying to find out first how semantics have evolved over time and also changed over time. That is one dimension. We're also trying to show that within the organizations we have different types of texts. Especially if you look at the World Bank, I think one of their main parts has actually, I mean, they have several main tasks. One apparent one is, of course, that they give out money, that they lend money to countries, and that they do programs on the ground. But they're also very much involved in the production of knowledge. So what they do also is produce enormous amount of texts. So we don't have a few hundred texts or documents that we can look at. We have tens of thousands of documents that we can look at. And I think this also shows that probably not in all the documents there's the same understanding of global inequality. So we're also looking at the comparison between different text types. Because you can imagine there's so many authors involved in the World Bank, but also in UNDP, but even more so in World Bank, that they will not all have the same understanding of this concept. And well, it's quite apparent that we're also looking at differences or maybe similarities between the definitions of global inequality between these two organizations. I mean, there's a whole lot of literature about World Bank and UNDP, but we're not just seeking to reconfirm what they've said, but also to show out really well. So I'm cutting short on the theory here. I think there's also actually some slides about what we've learned from the literature about global inequality, but I'm leaving that out and just trying to show you how we generated some questions for the analysis. I mean, we're very much coming from what we find in the text, but also we need to have some categories that we're actually looking at to sort out the massive amount of material that we're dealing with. So what we did is we read the mainstream of global inequalities literature and tried to show what's missing in these debates. So from our standpoint, the analysis is focused very much on income inequality and poverty. But when you compare it to the actual literature of social inequality you find within the nation state, the debate about global inequality is much narrower than what we usually find when we talk about social inequality. All the categories you find when you talk about social inequalities, like gender, like education, social status and so on, it's all missing from the literature about global inequality. So these are basically five very, very first and maybe very abstract questions that we're asking. The one is, what sort of patterns of language and use do we find that concern the characteristics of global inequalities? So that's the attributes of what is meant when we talk about global inequality. The second would be a more contextual look at the whole thing. So how is it embedded in a larger discourse? What sort of other meanings can there be found? And what discursive linkages do we find to meta-narratives? And when we say meta-narratives, we mean narratives that are not immediately concerned with inequality, but could mean something else. You'll see later in the illustrations that it concerns things like who has agency, who has access to certain things, how things are distributed, how is that related to certain dimensions of power, and so on. So these are meta-narratives in our understanding. The third question concerns the subjects and agents of social inequality. So who's meant when we talk about inequality? Is it about states? Is it about individuals? Is it about certain groups? And so on. And are these subjects endowed with the potential to act? Are they, would they be able to overcome inequality, or are they seen as victims of inequality? And so on. The fourth question is that we look for reasons giving for inequality and what can be done against it. And this, I think, is very important, because if you suggest a strategy to fight against social inequality, you must have an idea of why we have social inequality or global inequality. So what reasons are given for the whole idea of social and global inequality, and what can be done against that? And the last question is concerned with socio-spatial representations of inequality. It's quite obvious why we're doing that, because the project is concerned with the question of global inequalities, and the global plays a very important role for us. Because if you use the word global, of course there's a whole literature of globalization, of what global could mean, and we're interested in seeing, is that really relevant when we talk about global inequalities and development discourse? Do they really reflect what it means that something is global? Or do they just use the term and have such a variety of ideas concerning it? So these are the five questions. I'm not systematically going to say something about everything, it's just a sort of information about the categories. So this is the part where it gets very concrete. This is what we've been doing so far. What we're doing now is that we're analyzing officially accessible documents of the World Bank, and for World Bank everything is accessible on the internet. There's no reason to go to the archives. When the project was planned, there was a plan to get money, and there is money to go to the archives of the World Bank and of UNDP, but for the World Bank it's completely unnecessary because everything's online, and UNDP doesn't have an archive. They threw away all of their old documents. So if we're lucky, we'll find some in some libraries somewhere, maybe in Germany, maybe in the US, but there's no archive. So we have all this nice money, and I'm going to be going to the United States in October, but no archive. Anyway, with one complaint, there's no lack of documents, so always on the safe side when it comes to that. One important thing is that, and I can't stress it enough, we have such a number of documents, it's of course quite evident that we can't analyze 40,000 or 50,000 documents. It's just not something we can give any reliable information about. Of course we can do it technically, that's not really the problem, but we have to have some overview of what these documents really mean. I mean, we can't just analyze documents and then see what we found. We have to be able to give some information about the context, what they mean, how they are perceived, where they are produced, and so on. So we have to make a choice of documents, and this cannot be an automatic choice. We can't just say, well, we just use these and these because we like the titles. We have to be very sure what we're finding when we look at these documents. So choosing the documents is already part of the analysis. And it really, really took some time. We did it in the very early stages, and of course that means we have to have at least vague impression of what the different document types refer to. We have to have an idea who they're meant for, who writes them, what's part of the general idea of these text types, and of course this also has to relate to the overall question. So this is something one tends to underestimate, that the choice of documents is already part of the analysis. And of course, when we do the project, we have to account for every step, and we have to make sure that we document each analytical step and give the reasons why we did that. Actually, when we started out doing that, I'm reading all protocols now. I don't really remember what we were thinking at those times. I'm really glad we wrote it all down, because you tend to forget in the process of doing the project what you were thinking about in the early stages. So I think it's really important to stress that. Also, we need to have text corpora of World Bank and UNDP that are to some extent comparable. We can't have 50,000 World Bank documents and just 10,000 UNDP documents. Otherwise, I mean, it would be very difficult to compare and have some valid results. So that also is something we need to keep in mind when we choose the documents, how to be able to compare the different amount of documents. And of course, as I said, World Bank has more documents than UNDP, so the text corpora are not the same size, but we try to make sure that they're at least somehow comparable. And we've talked to experts. It's impossible to do it without knowing what the text types really refer to, because they have so different titles. There's different sorts of documents, and it's, when you just have a look at them, it's really very difficult to discern what they could mean. So we talk to people who know UNDP, who know the World Bank, in order to be able to find out which documents could be similar in both organizations. And then the technical preparation was something we didn't really plan with when the project was designed, and I'm sure we already talked about that. It's much more time consuming than you expect. Actually, we have 4 student assistants in the project, and they haven't been doing anything but downloading documents and converting them from up. So the technical preparation means you have to download several thousands of documents. I'm glad I didn't have to do that. It's, I think, tedious and boring and time consuming. We had to use a text converter program. We used OmniPage, that different ones, I think. I'm not sure if anyone's done that. It's also very time consuming to do that. We had to change them from PDFs to TXT documents for the sole reason that in the documents we have columns, and the program we're using for the text analysis can't read columns. So if we can't get rid of these columns, the program is not able to see what's in one paragraph and what's in the next, so it conflates words, and then of course the result would be quite useless. So that's the step we have to do. Also, and that's another step that sounds quite easy, we have to have a folder structure that we can all refer to. So when we save the documents, we have to have some sort of structure that everyone can understand, because there's not one person in the project involved, but several persons. And I know it sounds like a very basic thing, but it's really something that you have to figure out while you're doing it. So, I know you can't read anything, that's okay. It's just to give you an impression of how we tried to sort out the documents in the beginning. So that's a quantitative overview of some of the World Bank documents, just one of many, many, many pages, where we try to note down how many documents of each text type we find, then how many of those refer to certain categories, like geographical categories, either global, regional, or country-specific. Then how many documents we can find by a search that includes the word global and so on. So there's different ways of sorting through the material. And I'm sure, looking back from now, there would have been an easier way, but there was no one to show us. So we had to find out and have all these different considerations. And you can go to my colleague's office. He has 2 walls of just these documents to, with all these text types. Oh, we keep them there because it's so impressive, and we think everyone will see what we're doing in the project. But I think it really shows what sort of material there was in the beginning to sort through. And this is also in German, you don't have to be able to read it. So these are comments on all the different document types. So these are board documents. That is average length of the documents, the structure, then the sort of text presentation. We try to pull out documents that give only statistics. So since we're interested in the longer text, we try not to use the documents that only give statistics. This is sort of a very subjective evaluation of each of us. So there were 5 of us sorting through the documents, and only when we all said they're probably useful, we would use them. So we had to have some sort of subjective reliability. This is basically the verdict, should we take them or not? This is just the abbreviation that we would use. And this is one of 11 pages, I think, for one category of one organization. Well, I know it's a bit technical, but I think for me it's still interesting to see how we have eventually got to deciding what documents we would use or not. So again, not only of course using these very formal criteria, we try to also find analytical categories that would allow us to group the documents. So we can do it step by step. We don't have to do all the documents at the same time, because it's impossible. Also because we can make can get different information from those. So we first did analytical categories that depend on the document type. And the first one is a quite obvious category. It's key documents, those documents that I was mentioned most frequently when we talk about the World Bank or UNDP. You can find them in the literature. You can find them in terms of what documents are mostly referred to when people talk about the World Bank. So these are the first category. Also operative documents, of course, a very different thing from programmatic documents. You have very abstract categories of, let's say, gender equality, and you have very operative documents that are concerned with what single projects in a certain country, in a region, in this country, the World Bank does, what sort of money that they allocate to do these programs. And of course, in terms of, I'm talking about global inequality, they have a very different function. So it's much easier, of course, to see the very abstract programmatic documents. And for a later stage, we have to see whether we can still deal with these operative documents, because they are, of course, the main part of what World Bank does. We can't ignore them. Also, of course, geographical categories are very interesting for us, since we're interested in the idea of the global. Then thematic documents, so these are documents that deal with a certain issue, and differing between World Bank and UNDP, so they have UNDP and World Bank have very different structures of operation. The World Bank is a very centralized organization, and UNDP is very much decentralized. They don't do much in their head offices. They work very much on a country and region level basis. So of course they have a very different way of ordering their documents. And they tend to have more thematic documents than general programmatic documents. So this is another way of doing that. Also, we thought it would be interesting to see what the context of text production is. So whether we have official speeches by the president, for example, or whether we have documents, again, that might be very operative or just for internal use. I mean, these are documents that could also be very interesting, like board reports, documents that are only for the sake of the organization itself. I don't mind. Yeah, whatever. And also the last one, this is probably a very problematic category, whether we can sort documents according to who are the potential recipients. So are they meant for a broader public? Are they meant for a very specific discussion of experts? Are they meant for just the people in the organization and so on? So these could be different ways of ordering. So far we've only come to analyzing the key documents, and I think usually most projects would be happy with just analyzing the key documents. I think that's what's commonly done when you do text analysis. So we hope not just to stick to the key documents, but get on to also other documents. So these are the analytical categories. This is the more abstract way. And then we also have to have, of course, very concrete text corpora. So we have to pick folders of which we know exactly which texts are included in the folders. So as to later be able to say, to see what's the potential generalizability or the potential limits of these, of the things we can actually say about them. And I think it's repetitive to some point, so we can do temporal comparisons within the organization, we can do comparison between World Bank and UNDP over time based on topics. So these are again the different comparative dimensions, and there are probably more comparative dimensions. It's just the most obvious thing. This is a table stating what documents are included in which category, only for the two first categories. So this is the first one's key documents, and contains these documents of the World Bank and these documents of UNDP, even figuring out which documents sort of equal those of the other took us some weeks. It's absurd if you see how slowly the project really progresses, and it was really frustrating in the beginning that we wanted to get started, and all we did was sort through text and have tables after tables after tables. I'm not sure how many tables we have so far, but quite a number of tables just to sort through the documents. And I hope it will eventually really be worth it. We just hope so. So these are key documents, the other one are operative documents, the third one is country-specific documents, and the fourth would be intra-organizational communication, and I think that's especially interesting for all of those, and I count myself among them, who are interested in international organizations as a field of research. So I'm coming from this whole research field of international organizations, and I think, and also again, hope it will be worthwhile. So I hope this is not too much small information for you, but we would have to talk about something. And now I'm really letting you look into how we're doing the project. Maybe too much of reality, I'm not sure. So basically, what we can do when we do a corpus linguistic analysis, an analysis I'm concerned with quite a number of texts and interested not in statements but in semantics, is basically two things. You can either work on a corpus-driven base or on a corpus-based base. So what we're doing is corpus-driven, which means that we, of course, we have some preconceived ideas. We know what we're looking for, but we're not using these categories to code text. We take what we get, and then we, from there on, we follow the analysis and then relate it back to our analytical categories. So we're not taking the analytical categories and put them on the text. We're trying to see what's in the text and then find out from there whether that really relates to the research questions we have or not. So the other thing would be corpus-based, and I think that's what most people do who do content analysis. They usually have some codes before they start, or they have some categories, and then they code text according to these categories. So that's basically not what we're doing. The reason why we chose the corpus-driven approach is because we're going to do two phases of research. The first is the corpus linguistic analysis, and the second step is the discourse analysis, and I'll show you which one will be used at what stage. And I think in terms of compatibility of methods or theoretical approaches, the corpus-driven one is the more compatible with discourse analysis. But of course that is my definition, or our definition of discourse analysis. So the things we can do with a, Wordsmith, by the way, is the word of the program we're using. It's very infamous now. I think everyone in the research center knows it because it's a program we've come to not especially love, maybe not hate, but we've come to deal with a lot. And we very much rely on its limits and the potential. So what we can do is we can process a large amount of text. Can generate quantitative data, maybe not for those who are doing real quantitative work, but for someone coming from qualitative research such as I am. This is quantitative data, I suppose it depends on the perspective. When we can talk about the frequency of certain terms, we can talk about comparative frequency, and we can talk about collocations, so co-occurrences of terms, and I'll show you what that means. But first of all, it's too small. But this is what Wordsmith looks like. It's a very simple program. Well, in terms of the surface, it's a really simple program. It was designed by someone who comes from linguistics. So it's a linguistic program. It's not meant for social science research, but I think it doesn't really matter. But the things you can do with it are probably more than we're going to use. We're not looking for phonemes and lexemes or morphemes and stuff like that. We could actually do that with the program, but we're not going to do that. So the three central functions, and to some extent we're following them, is you can make word lists. They just show you the number of certain tokens. You can calculate keyness values. And they show you that they're always about comparison, so they show you certain, if you look at one document comparing it with a reference corpus, it shows you the relative frequency of words compared to in the one document compared to the reference corpus. And the third thing is can do collocations of frequent co-occurrences of set tokens, which helps to characterize, if you look at, take the example of inequality, it helps to characterize the attributes used frequently in the context, for example, of inequality. So we'll show you if poverty is used frequently in this context, or if we find words like access, distribution, and so on. Basically, very simple functions, very useful. So this is really just an illustration. It's not, I mean, there's no real statement behind that. So these are word lists, just giving you an impression of the difference between the amount of words that, like and the first one are numbers. The program is not able to give you numbers, it can only tell you that there are numbers.
You just wonder why it's in Russian, I mean.
Yeah, that's interesting. I think that is what the program did actually, because my program can't do that. Interesting. It adapted it. Fantastic. So you can see the first words, of course, are very expected, and the in, of, and so on. But here we find women, and when we look at the source of gender equality, it's not that surprising. I mean, these lists usually aren't that surprising, especially when it comes to the first, let's say, 20 tokens. It becomes more interesting if you look at words that are not expected. Are there any? No, probably not in this list. Sometimes you find unexpected words. In this list, I think everything could be fairly expected. When you read the title gender equality, I think you wouldn't be too surprised to find women, gender, female, economic, and so on. So, I mean, these are the most obvious things, but sometimes they're more useful. When it comes to keywords, and this is about the same text, this is also not very unexpected. This shows you, when we compare the one report about gender equality with the reference corpus of all World Development Reports, then we can see that women is statistically overrepresented when compared to the overall corpus of all World Development Reports. And again, this is not surprising when it's about gender equality. We expect that to happen. But of course, we can't rely on the title too much. So in terms of reliability, we would be able to say, well, obviously this report is concerned very much with women and gender. Well, as I said, I mean, here it's not very surprising because it's already in the title. So we use the easy cases to hit to give the illustrations. So this is about keywords. These are collocations. You can't read it again, but it's okay. I did collocations for the word development, which is stuff is the development, and the list is able to give you all the words that occur in one sentence close to development, and you can tell the program whether you want to the word on the one way, one word to the left, two words to the left, one word to the right, and so on. I mean, it's quite obvious that you can have different ways of depicting this, and it becomes, once you've gotten into the program and have some experience, you know, probably also, it's also of course a linguistic program. It would be different in Russian, German, and English, which were probably the most interesting. And once you have some experience, you know what to look for and where the interesting things could be found. But of course, the thing is, the program only helps you to depict the data. It doesn't give you data that tells you anything. You still have to interpret it. If you find this list, I mean, there could be a number of things connected to development. Some words could just be, you know, from the title, because the report is called the World Development Report or something. So, of course, the world development is expected to occur quite often. And sometimes it's completely misleading. But so you have to look into the whole list and draw conclusions from that. It's just, you know, just makes it easier to sort through these massive amount of text. The interpretation is still something you have to do yourself, which is something we have to realize again and again. So the discourse analysis then would come in as a second step after generating a lot of material in the corpus linguistic analysis. But the corpus linguistic analysis can give us is patterns of language in use and patterns of semantic shifts of the larger developments. Everything else, I think, has to be done in a discourse analysis. So the discourse analysis would help us to study in more detail the presuppositions of what is produced in the text, the subjects and the potential agency, the relations between subjects and power structure within this whole discourse analysis. And also, of course, the discourse analysis serves to contextualize what we find. So we can't just say, well, we have a text here, and the text talks about this and that. We also have to make sure that we understand what the how the text is produced. So if we look at an overall discourse, we have to know whether, for example, one document is already a reaction to criticism that was voiced by NGOs, or we have to know whether it's meant as a change of a programmatic change or something like that. So, I mean, still the work of the social science researcher we're doing is just aided by this tool of corpus linguistic and discourse analysis. So the discourse analysis, for example, would be reading this short paragraph. Please don't read it. It's really just a stupid example. And then seeing what you can learn from this text, and also, of course, on the basis of what we already know after the corpus linguistic analysis. So what presuppositions of the categories do we find? What do we find when we read about gender? So then I hear that gender only concerns the question of women. Does it concern equality? So this is nothing that the program can tell us. It's something we have to do ourselves, as I already said. So the subjects are reconstructed, how are they positioned towards another. I'm not sure who's familiar with the discourse analysis. I'm not going into the whole thing very deeply. It's something that I've been doing for a number of years and I'm really interested in, so if I started talking about that, I wouldn't be able to finish, and I think there's still something to go. But if you're interested in discourse analysis, as I said, I'm always willing to talk about that. So maybe it's time now for the illustration. It's not very impressive, so I saved that for last. Just about the project itself, the immediate further steps, I already said that I'm going to go to the US in October to initially visit the archives, but this is really just the rationale, getting money for it. Actually, I hope I can do several interviews, because I think it's of course very important to do the text analysis, and it's, I think this is really the main and most important part of the project. I think it would be also very interesting to do interviews not only about the question of global inequality, but also about how the World Bank and UNDP actually see the role of the text they produce. I mean, that would be something would be really interested to learn how they actually see what the different text types mean, how they see the importance of the programmatic things as to relate to the operative documents and so on. So just give you more information about the whole context. And I think it's really just also very different information from what you get when you just read the secondary sources and texts about the organizations themselves. It's always good to do interviews, I suppose. And possibly we will do a third comparative study. It's in the proposal, so we're supposed to do that. And also there's money to go to Paris, so it would be a waste not to do the study of OECD, but at the moment I can't really see how we can manage to do a third organization. We'll see. As for the project after 10 months, what are the expected results that might change next year or the year after, or when we finish the project, then maybe just one of these 4 points remains. What we expect to see are the differences between the international organizations and their understanding of inequality. I think we'll probably be able to say something about whether UNDP and World Bank have similar or very different understandings. Then similarities are perhaps even assimilation of the programs and concepts. That would be something very interesting also from a theoretical point of view. How do the two organizations influence each other? Is there a common discourse, or do they just do their separate stuff? How do they communicate with each other and so on? So that's something, I think from a sociological point of view that could be very interesting. more generally, I think we'll have some systematic overview of the development discourse that's concerned with social inequality, so we can say something about the overall discourse about global inequality as let's see, maybe shifts in semantics or contradictions in the programs, and I'm sure they're contradictions because they're always contradictions, although of course we may try to make problems look very consistent, usually they are not consistent. And finally, I think the functioning and interlinkages of World Bank and UNEP as organizations of world society, this is the more theoretical interest, also owing to a very specific tradition in Bielefeld. So these are the respective results. And now some more tables, I think. This what the first one just gives us an information in what context, terms are mentioned in the context of globality or the question of global. And we see two texts here, that's the World Development Report 2006 and the Human Development Report of 2011. That's the two main reports I'm going to talk about the following examples, because both are very much concerned with the question of equity, which is another very important term in the context of inequality. This is basically the information you get from the program. And if you look at it now, you can probably imagine that it is not so easy to just use this data and then have some reliable information that you can interpret and then, you know, write a lot about. It's just the first step of information. And you can see that, of course, you have to move on and really saturate your findings. So what we see here is we see the category of global in the context of equity, inequalities, but also many other things. We're talking about World Bank now, arena, markets, development, level. So very different terms that don't all have to do with inequality. And in the UNDP document, there's hardly any mention of inequality, equity, or equality. So global and inequality don't really seem to fit in the context of UNDP, which is of course a very frustrating finding because the project is concerned with the question of global inequalities, and we want it to be more than just a category that was invented for the whole set of the project. So this is already a bit of a frustrating finding, that only in the case of World Bank there seems to be a semantic connection between global and equity or inequality or equality. So this is something where we started the analysis and haven't really continued so far. So I'm just giving you bits of information just to illustrate how we work, and you won't be able to take anything home about global inequalities later on, just actually how we worked in the project. Again, we're turning down to the 2006 World Development Report and the 2011 Human Development Report. Now comparing them with the reference corpus of all World Development Reports and all Human Development Reports. And this is clusters of meaning in the context of inequality or unequal. The asterisk means that we didn't look for inequality or inequalities or inequality spelled incorrectly, but everything coming after unequal. So here you can see that in the World Development Report of 2006, income is the most important category, followed by education, health, and poverty. These are the main categories. I'm sure there are other categories, but they're statistically irrelevant, so they're not clear. And in the case of the Human Development Report, we find gender is the most important category, life expectancy, also income, development, poverty, maternal mortality, health, and world income. So there are more categories in the Human Development Report. But when you see, of course, the list for the overall reference corpus is much longer than for the single document. This is not unexpected, of course. I mean, in one document, you can only have so much information. But it's interesting to see for us, because we identified in the literature of global inequality that income really seems to be the one most important category when when there are debates about global inequality and development. And this seems to be confirmed in the case of the World Development Report, also to some extent in the Human Development Report, that their gender is also a very relevant category. And this is, of course, interesting because we can already see some differences with regard to World Bank and UNDP, but only slight differences. If we look again at the reference corpus, we will see that gender is also a very important category for World Bank. So, I mean, there's only so much the data tells us. In terms of quantitative differences, the numbers got lost for the UNDP reference corpus. Would have been interesting. I don't have them in mind, I'm sorry. These are not numbers I can recall right now. They were there at some point. Not sure where they are now. So again, we have to interpret this data, and we can only use it as a starting point to go in different directions now. So what we could do is, of course, look at the single reports again and see whether income is only mentioned in the context of inequality, or if income is related again to other terms that seem to be important, and relate these terms back to inequality and so on. So you can try to generate a picture that shows you whether this information is really reliable, whether you can really say that income and inequality are two terms that are frequently used together. And it's basically also what you did. So, and the same for gender and so on. So we have to see whether this is really relevant in some sense. Already what we can see is, I hope you remember the analytical categories that we use. So this is, you can go several ways from here. The first thing is, of course, that we try to find the definition of inequality comes to mean. And if we look at income, education, health, and poverty, these are very concrete issues. If we look at the Human Development Report, income is a very concrete category. Development, of course, is something that's a more of a meta-narrative. So the idea of development itself is not unexpected in a development report, but it's something that's more than income. It's a much broader kind of category than talking about income. And this would be something to look into more closely. Also, the idea of world income is interesting, because this is a category that would only be relevant in a certain context. Otherwise, I don't think that the idea of world income makes much sense. Again, this is just the data for the 2016 World Development Report. I already talked about these keynotes. So these are words that appear relatively or statistically significantly more often in the 2006 report than in all other World Development Reports. And again, not very surprisingly, we find inequality, equity, inequalities, unequal, equitable. I mean, this is basically the reason we chose this report. We expect to find this, but there are different other information we can learn from that. The yellow categories, the ones that are marked yellow, could refer to something that we call the meta-narratives. So the idea of political distribution, wealth, opportunity is something that is refers to other discourses. So there are discourses about the question of the political when it comes to inequality. The question of distribution is, of course, something that doesn't only have to do with income. It means there's a whole idea behind this concept of distribution, also about opportunity, rights, power, access, and so on. So these could be meta-narratives that might be interesting to look into more closely. So the next step will always be that we take these terms and try to see control for these terms, whether in the context of this report they're mentioned mostly in the context of inequality, or if they're mentioned mostly in the context of other things. And of course we did that, and we only if they also mention inequality systematically within the two terms can be connected. So we always, of course, have to control for these terms and see whether the relationship is sort of mutual. And then you can see also what of course, is also connected to these meta-narratives. The turquoise or blue marks indicate something that could be subject of inequality. kids, only children placed in groups. Of course, what is missing from this list, because it's about over-representation and not about the most frequent terms that appear, is something like gender. We don't find gender in this list, which again is not very surprising, because the question of gender is probably not discussed only in the context of inequality, but in many other contexts. So there's no reason why we should find gender in this document, because it's probably most frequent, relatively frequently used in all the contexts. Slowly. Okay. So whether children is relevant or not, we have to we also have to check for that. And this is the list where we check for children in the same document. And you can see this list doesn't tell us anything. I mean, it tells us something, but it's not really conclusive. It doesn't really help to see what the idea of children and inequality, how they are related. You can have some assumptions about that, but I think this list really isn't very conclusive. It doesn't tell you why children are mentioned in the context of inequality. It gives you some impression that the list is so broad that it's really difficult to see from this list what it could mean. Mm-hmm.
Can I ask you a question? Whether this list was going from the 3 grams? Is it just 3 grams from the corpus?
Yeah. Just from this document, this one document. Was that your question?
Yeah. Okay. Well, usually you can get much of information just coming through grams.
Mm-hmm. I don't really get that.
It was just...
Why there are 3 words in any collocations?
Mm-hmm.
Why you decided to use 3 words, not 2 words, not 4 words?
Oh, but that's what the program does.
I suppose you can change.
You can change it, exactly. You can change the number of words in the cluster. But this, didn't really matter in this context, because if you use 4 words or 2 words or something else, I don't think that finding would be more conclusive. My point, to go back to what I was saying, is not that the information is useless, but I think it shows you that there are some limits to the corpus linguistic analysis. So in order to be really able to say why children are mentioned in the context of global inequality, I don't think the program would help us very much. I think this is really the point to start doing the discourse analysis and going into the text. Of course, we can start from these clusters, but as you can see, the number of clusters is really small. I mean, there's 5 incidents of child help, so we probably have to go into the text and see what they're really concerned with. If you have questions about this, please brief listeners. I don't want to confuse anyone.
But why do you rely on statistics? Have you tried to do linguistic analysis, maybe find patterns from syntactic structures?
Why? What would you do with that?
I mean, why rely on statistics when you find some semantic conclusions find some sense?
Well,
why do you rely on statistics?
Yeah.
Basically, that's my question.
Well, that's because, as I said repeatedly, we have such a huge amount of text. And in order, well, if you do a discourse analysis, let me phrase it like that. The thing you can do is you can read text and analyze it. But how are you going to read 10,000s of texts? It's impossible. So you need the program to give you the structure of information that you can later use for a discourse analysis. That's the sole reason.
Well, at least you can get some syntactic structures,
yes.
Not just 3 grams.
You can get discourse structures.
Yes, of course. I'm just giving you illustrative examples of some of the steps of the analysis. It's not all we did. I mean, we haven't done in 1 year 2 graphs where we just found 3 words. That's not the point. My point is to show how far you can get with a frequency analysis, and of course there are different functions in the program. I'm not finished with the talk, but I understand your point, but also let me use your imagination. How are you going to do a syntax analysis of 10,000 documents, and what can you show with the syntax analysis? I don't think it's the information we want to have. So we have a research question. I think this is what helps. If you have alternative ideas, I'm gladly discussing them later on. Maybe I didn't really get your the question, right?
In campaign, maybe you first write the report and then we open
exactly.
the discussion.
I think it's easier for me to. So, and then the third category of things in this table is the things that we mark green. Coming from the research question we have, these are words that seem to be, sort of surprising, or words that not necessarily matter in this context. So, again, pointing to the number of texts we have to analyze and all the material we can make either the decision to ignore these words and not look into them, or we say, well, in the first text, in order to be sure that we're not losing too much material, we look at what playing and evidence could mean, and in what context they use, and what other context they use. So these are words that are not immediately, have no immediate connection to inequality, and as I said, either we ignore them or we look into them, depending on the time, of course. So again, I think this is repetitive. Interesting. I think the slide was meant to be somewhere in the beginning, because it's number one. So you already have the information. That's good. Repetition. I think it's always helpful. And I was going to finish with. That's all. This is something that the program can do. I'm not sure. It's not really the best way of conveying information. I think it's just useful for presentations and for reinterpreting what you find. So this is one fancy function of the program called word cloud. It's not its best feature, but I think it's the fanciest probably. This is comparing the keywords in the context of equity. So when we look at the World Development Report and the Human Development Report, I think what's quite clear is that there's a huge number of collocations, including equity and proficiency, which I think is a very interesting and conclusive finding. And in the context of the Human Development Reports, there's no such clear connection as equity and proficiency. So the highest instances are between equity and human development properly, and human development equity, human development. So there's some sort of pattern you can find. And I think looking at these things, they don't tell you anything if you don't reinterpret them. So again, it gives us some data to interpret and to see whether, for example, we look at the idea of efficiency as something that's specific for the World Bank or something that's specific for the discourse about equity. And I think in this case, we can say that equity and efficiency are not necessarily related, they're just related in the context of the World Bank. And we don't find this, I think, in the case of Human Development Report. So this is something you can do to make comparison easier, and especially for PowerPoints, I think it's rather charming, but I've listened to many presentations over the last years that have used these word clouds and word clouds and word clouds and word clouds and haven't told you anything, so this is something to also be very cautious about, because I mean, it looks nice, but you have to really be sure of what it means. And I think the good thing is, of course, that the fat and bold printing already indicates a higher relevance, statistical or quantitative relevance, than the smaller, not so bold things. But apart from that, again, you have to interpret the data. And I thought I had conclusions, but I lost them on the way. But anyway, I mean, the only conclusion so far is that we think we have found a way of dealing with a huge amount of data, but we have no empirical results so far that are really reliable. For me, the most interesting thing, of course, is to see what we can really learn from the data, because I had to produce a paper for a conference at the end of the week, and it was necessary that we have some empirical findings, so I had generated a huge amount of data, and then it was very difficult to really see what you could do with it. Because you have all these tables, and you have all these numbers, and you have all these very interesting findings, but it's very difficult to interpret them if you don't know the context, if you don't know what you're looking for. So only when you relate them back to the categories that we already have, what are the subjects, or they begin to make sense. And again, let me stress, I think for me the main approach is the discourse analysis, and in order to be able to do discourse analysis of such a high amount of text, you need some way to structure the information. And for me, the corpus linguistic analysis is just a way of structuring information, of giving me some idea about patterns that you find, because I don't think, well, if you have, let's say, just 100 documents, you can find patterns by just reading and marking out and maybe counting. But if you have 10,000 of documents, the only reliable information you can get about patterns is if you really do a frequency analysis, if you have the numbers there, if you really see whether it's just an impression you have or whether this information is also confirmed by frequency analysis. And I think that's hopefully enough information for more questions. Thank you.
You can ask very short questions and the discussion will be later, okay? Any questions?
Okay, the question was why haven't you eliminated all the stop words? Like, why haven't you eliminated all the stop words? Like, are, you, in,
oh.
The, why haven't you eliminated the stop words?
Oh, we did that now. I mean, you can easily do that. It's no problem to do with the problem. I just wanted to show you when the relevant information starts to appear in the data. But that's the easiest way to do it. I mean, if you really did it, if you were really a linguist, you could eliminate this information because you also have to interpret this information. But I think this is going far too deep for us, so we just eliminate it. So, yeah, we did that.
Well, since you have these two beautiful corpora at your disposal, and what I think both of them are pretty interesting for the researcher, I was just wondering if you have any plans of making them available on the internet, because I'd love to use them somehow.
I think you can if we meet later. Then.
I mean, if it is technically available.
Yeah. I probably have to send you one of our external hard drives of 2 terabytes, but it should be feasible.
Well, another one question. There's lots of open data initiatives in UM and so,
yeah.
So on. And you haven't found any user of them for your research.
What exactly do you mean?
Have you found any use of them for your research from the open data initiatives?
Not yet. I mean, we're only using the documents that are available anyway, so. But the thing is, in terms of the Collaborative Research Center, I think one of the conditions to get the money was that all the data we use will be available for secondary analysis. So what we have to do is somehow document what we're doing with the data, how we sorted it, how we decided what to include, what not to include. So the researchers today can also use the data that we have. So maybe we're more part of the open data initiative ourselves, I suppose. But this will be for a later stage. I mean, first we have to take everything out of the data that we can get.
Can I ask you a question, a more technical question?
Oh, I'm not sure I can answer it.
No, I mean, could you describe briefly the pipeline of your text processing? Like, what are the main basic steps? What should you do? I mean, you just run statistics and that's it. You have pretty good categories of the documents.
Can you rephrase it? I didn't get it.
No, well. Because in this room there's a lot of linguistics, and we're kind of interested in how the process of the text processing. It might be interesting for us, for instance, if you could just briefly describe how you do the processing of the documents.
You mean what steps we take?
Yeah, well, just
okay.
Well,
I mean, my experience so far is very limited, so I can only, you know, it's basically a very grounded theory approach that I'm taking out of the data, so I can only give you a first impression. It might change later on. So of course, I mean, the frequency analysis is something that's just the very, very, very first information, just to give you an idea what we you might find in the data. I'm not very fond of these frequency things. As I said, I come from qualitative research, and I'm very, let's say, skeptical about this data. I think what we need it for is to show that we're not just having an impressionistic look at some data, but that we have some reliable information about what seems to be relevant and what does not seem to be relevant in terms of single tokens, not in terms of broader structure. But the most interesting thing, I think, are co-occurrences or collocations, where you can, like the small patterns, you correctly remarked upon that we use the one with three tokens, and of course, because you can add broader ones. We're not looking at syntax. It's not something it's interesting information. I also study linguistics, so it's interesting for me as a researcher, but not for the project. So we only look at the information that gives us an impression about what inequality is characterized, and of course the most basic thing is to look for co-occurrences in the context of inequality, and then going to broader concepts like the meta-narratives use, and then of course contextualizing them in terms of what's the broader idea of development, what's the broader idea of gender, and so on. So this already, I think, is a more discourse analytical approach on that. So my meta frame is the discourse analysis, and I'm trying to just get data that I can use for the discourse analysis. The theoretical approach I'm coming from is deconstruction, so I'm looking for, say, dichotomies for contradictory terms to how subjects are positioned, what relations are between subjects, and so on. It's not very linguistic, it's more of a sociological or philosophical approach. I'm not sure if that's satisfying for you, but
you answered my question.
So, when you're talking about discourse analysis, I'm planning to do it in a more automatic way, not just backhand.
Well, I have a certain theoretical predisposition where I'm coming from, so I could give you that, and I think that basically instructs how I work when I talk about discourse analysis. Because, I mean, there's so many different approaches you can take to discourse analysis that we have to make sure where you stand from a theoretical point of view.
No, just my question is just whether you're going to do it by hand, or there will be some way.
No, I'm doing it by hand, based on the data we have.
With such amount of textual data.
Yeah, but the thing is, I think there only can be a combination of, you have to find a way of combining the two techniques. So some people have done it, but it's quite a new way of doing it, especially with the amount of data. So I think for me, it always means that I have to go back to one step to do the next, and then go back to the other step. So there can never be a finished, or a finite corpus data that I use for the discourse analysis, and there can never be a discourse analysis that doesn't go back to the corpus linguistic analysis, I think. Or just do it in one way. And that's the reason why we try to find all these categories of the like, key documents, operative documents, and so on, so that we can have one corpus at a time and see how we can really work with that, and then maybe move on to the next. But the thing is, we have so many things we don't really know how they're going to turn out. It was still a sort of experimental phase. I hope to convey the information in more than we do. But as I said, I wrote one paper that I think basically there are limits to the corpus linguistic analysis. And for me, the discourse analysis is more important. But in order to make sure that we're not just giving very small amount of food, we actually we have to have the data from the corpus analysis. So it's basically a combination of the two approaches, and I think it's the best way to do that.
Sure, of course.
Have you ever heard of discourse approach, of discourse corpus linguistics?
Yes.
Sure. And haven't you tried to use that?
Well, I mean, there's not one way to do it. So what I found in the literature is that people also combine the two techniques. And I mean, depending on what sort of, as I said, for me, it's important to have a theoretically saturated idea of what a discourse is and why I would do a discourse analysis. And I already have my idea about how to do a discourse analysis. So basically what I'm doing is I try to generate data that helps me to do this sort of discourse analysis. The corpus linguistic analysis is only a way of making sure that I'm not missing out on too much of the data. So, it's a very pragmatic approach towards the analysis, I suppose, but you're right. I mean, there are some approaches exist.
Коллеги, ну у нас запланировано второе выступление, именно мое, оно будет намного короче, и потом тогда можно открыть дискуссию. Хорошо? Спасибо.
Очень интересно проследить содержание. вероятную цепочку. Каким образом от экспертных отчетов, от экспертных каких-то ключевых концептов и ключевых слов можно продвинуться к принятию государственных решений, к социальному действию и так далее. Вот. То есть, в принципе, он очень широк и для методологов, и для социологов, и для математиков. Но, тем не менее, в данном отчете я как раз хотела лишь сконцентрироваться и только на возможности обработки массива данных из официальных отчетов. Ну, вот по той части, что мы уже посмотрели, обработали, стало понятно, что неравенство – такая вот штука, разворачивающаяся как бы и вниз, и вот по направлению развития вот этих самых социальных действий. То есть, смотрите, у нас неравенство, вот то, чем как бы, мы с Катей занимаемся, это исследование как бы, неравенства, как оно представлено на уровне речевых маркеров, как эти речевые маркеры группируются в содержательные концепты, и как, собственно, вот эти вот содержательные концепты потом выстраиваются в общую дискурс-структуру текста или структуру концепта. Но проявления неравенства могут быть рассмотрены, ну, во-первых, на разных уровнях, да, для разных социальных групп, на уровне правительств, стран, и также могут использоваться различные показатели неравенства, индикаторы, индексы, рейтинги, международные и так далее. Вот, и потом в этих вот официальных экспертных отчетах неравенство разворачивается в описании способов преодоления неравенства. Причем самое интересное, что вот эта вот первая головочка, там где неравенство написано, составляет очень небольшую долю всего текста. То есть гораздо больше посвящено способам преодоления неравенства и ожидаемому результату преодоления неравенства. Да? То есть выстраиванию новых каких-то ценностей экономических, моральных, там, социальных моделей и так далее. Да, с точки зрения способов преодоления неравенства активно упоминаются разные виды социальных действий, которые необходимо применить. Там упоминаются программы, организации, какие-то мировые акторы, которые вот, могут быть заинтересованы в преодолении вот этого самого неравенства и так далее. Если посмотреть, как выстраивается структура данных по отчетам, то я, вот, конечно, хочу подчеркнуть очень большую техническую часть обработки, потому что, вы представляете, это несколько тысяч текстов. То есть мы сейчас вот, пока вот, на этом как бы, пилотном этапе обработали, просто перевели в формат текста вручную. Катя уже говорила, что никакая программа это не берет, потому что там колонки начинают смешиваться и так далее. Вот, всего там ну, порядка 400 текстов. Вот на этих 400 текстов вот, стало как бы, понятно, как дальше вести работу. Вот, и фактически как бы, вот, подход может быть такой двойной. Да? То есть, с одной стороны, статистически, когда мы берем общее вот это среднее температуру по больнице, представление концептов и маркеров по всем текстам. И второй подход – это лингвистический, ну такой социолингвистический. Но социолингвистический, как это тоже совершенно справедливо заметила, это невозможно поднять на вот всем корпусе текстов. Или это будет очень проблемно. И все равно это потребует очень большую часть вот такой вот оперативной ручной работы. Вот, ну как минимум, если вот делать такой заход там, широким неводом, да, то первое, что в голову приходит, это, как бы, во-первых, заполнить базу данных просто по текстам. Две части. Первая часть, так называемая, эвристическая, экспертная. То есть это охарактеризовать тексты, то есть то, что Катя делала. Вот, но у нас это немножечко другие как бы, характеристики, более такая широкая вот эти вот поля, то есть там тема отчета, регионы, язык отчета, авторы, организации, источники данных и так далее. И очень показательны такие вот интересные характеристики, как объем всего текста, объем аннотаций, потому что очень часто аннотация занимает половину вообще всего отчета. А аннотация – это вот как бы такой суть, содержательная выжимка из всего текста. И там зачастую очень мало как раз каких-то статистических вещей описательных. И достаточно много вещей, которые как раз говорят, что нужно делать после того, как вот мы исследуем вот ту или иную как бы, страну и какие нужно, необходимо применить методы для того, чтобы это все дело искоренить. Вот, соответственно, вот эта вот первая часть, это такая вот экспертная часть, а вторая это техническая частотная, да, то есть это буквально векторизация всего массива, сколько раз в этом тексте встретилось то или иное слово.
Значит, в принципе, вот вы спрашивали про порядок действий, ну, мы вот как бы с нашей группой видим такой порядок действий, да, то есть понятно, что здесь параллельно приходится двигаться и на техническом уровне, и на содержательном. На техническом уровне это, понятно, сбор массива данных отчетов, там из открытых каких-то возможных источников, перевод отчетов в формат TXT, это вот отдельная такая техническая проблема. Вот, и дальше кодирование названий файлов, и как бы как раз на содержательном этапе можно посмотреть помимо инет-логики поиск других речевых каких-то маркеров ключевых, да, которые вот не инет-логики, но они где-то вот рядом находятся. Вот, и дальше что? Дальше как раз происходит такое распиливание, разделение файлов на вот такие подбазы данных. То есть, во-первых, это полные отчеты, безусловно. Потом резюме отчета, то есть корпус аннотации, корпус резюме отчетов представляет отдельную интересную тему для анализа. И отдельное вот это третье направление – это выделение абзацев или параграфов, где вот как раз наши ключевые слова и хранятся. То есть неравенство, бедность, там что-то еще и так далее. И дальше уже это все, вот эти вот, когда подготовлены вот эти массы, их отправляем на этап обработки данных. Вот, и, соответственно, понятно, полные отчеты, резюме отчета могут быть обработаны статистически, то есть методом, допустим, инженерного шкалирования или любыми другими статистическими методами. А вот как бы резюме и абзацы, носящие ключевые речевые маркеры, то есть их как раз тоже нужно будет параллельно еще закодировать, как-то разделить на какие-то группы, как раз можно использовать вот здесь лингвистические различные способы выстраивания таких цепочек слов и так далее, и уже дальше выявлять вот эти структуры смысловых концептов. Вот, ну и дальше представление результатов. Да, понятно, что у нас содержательная часть может быть большая, она может быть может пересекаться на любые уровни анализа, там страновые, социальные уровни и так далее. Это уже дальше мы будем смотреть. Вот. Ну и вот, как я сказала, там всего вот, там, за летний такой период нам удалось технически перевести всего там небольшое количество файлов, но тем не менее уже достаточно какая-то интересная получается статистика там, по знакам, по словосочетаниям, предложением, количество слов, это все у нас считало ура-автомат. Вот. Ну и среднее количество слов в предложении 10, поэтому, в принципе, вот Катин подход выявления триад, он представляется релевантным. Почему? Потому что как бы, триада – это минимальная такую трехсторонняя единица, как бы устойчивость, которую потом, в принципе, можно сложить любую конструкцию. Поэтому с точки зрения потом вот из этих триад строить вот такую дискурсивную структуру, в принципе, я считаю, что это будет очень неплохой. Как вот, то есть среднее количество слов в предложении это 3 триады фактически. Значит, если посмотреть по частоте, это не вот самые какие-то верхние слова взяла. Вот, давайте посмотрим, какие слова у нас находятся на самом верху вот, от той как бы, таблички и вот здесь. Вот. И там интересно, помимо вот во всем вот этом корпусе, там 70 текстов. Значит, первая колоночка идет, ну, концепт, потом частота, а потом количество текстов, в которых встречается это слово. Значит, оно само по себе может быть не сильно интересно, но давайте обратим внимание, во-первых, на то, где находится слово inequality, ну, практически в конце списка. Это там где-то тысячное слово, если вот во всем вот этом списке смотреть, по всему корпусу. То есть оно далеко не самое первое. Гораздо раньше него находятся другие слова. И в частности, посмотрите, слова GDP, HDI, ну какие-то еще. То есть это что такое? Это говорит о том, что в тексте про неравенство, об inequality, ключевыми являются даже не какие-то слова, а являются одним из ключевых вещей международные индикаторы. То есть у нас тексты, по которым делают как бы, анализ стран, они опираются не на какие-то собственные исследования, а прежде всего опираются на те же самые мировые рейтинги. То есть у нас получается такая зацикленная ссылочка. Да, мировые банки и UNDP ссылаются на рейтинговые агентства, а рейтинговые агентства ссылаются на их исследования. Да, что реально происходит в стране. Вот как раз очень интересно вот это смотреть. Вот, и если мы посмотрим вот тоже просто на частотное распределение, точнее на два частотных распределения, частота слов и частота текстов, в которые употребляются эти слова, у нас вот такие два интересных распределения получается. Ну, то есть здесь как бы понятно, вот интересно нижнее. То есть давайте посмотрим, если самые часто употребляются
употребляемые слова, они у нас, ну, примерно равномерно распределены. Вот потом в конце там идет длинный-длинный хвост, где одно слово в одном тексте, это неинтересно. Нам интересна вот эта вот средняя часть, где самое большое колебание. То есть и слов достаточно много, и колебания достаточно как бы широкие. Это о чем говорю? Что они распределены по текстам статистически неравномерно. То есть они каким-то образом зависят от внутренних законов вот распределения, может быть, цели написания текстов и так далее. Поэтому вот эти слова, вот энергетики входят вот в эту среднюю часть, они как раз нам наиболее интересны для анализа и могут быть подвергнуты статистическому анализу. Значит, ну, например, вот я самые часто употребляемые слова вот по нашим 370 текстам взяла, там 369, вот и провела просто тупо по ним многомерное шкалирование. Вот, ну, мне они показались интересны. То есть можно там еще там какую-то базу теоретическую под это под все вводить. Вот, ну, вот я просто для примера, что можно сделать. Вот, и давайте посмотрим, что у нас в центре вот этой вот как бы диаграммки находятся как раз вот эти самые индексы. То есть там вот коррупция, поверки, то есть все остальные, ну, такие вот описательные, эмоциональные слова, они у нас вообще-то разбегаются по периферии. А вот ядром, как бы, выделения и выстраивания отношений становятся как раз вот эти CPI, AG, HID, GDP и так далее, да, индекс, индикаторс, то есть это вот как бы ключевой, такое сугестивное, вот это ключевое слово, да, которое вот придает вес, собственно, вот этим исследованиям. Вот для меня это было достаточно интересно. Ну, также понятно, что мы можем провести обратный анализ. И каким-то, вот я просто 15 там случайно выбранных текстов вот random sample сделала в этом SPSS-е, вот они мне сразу как-то сгруппировались. То есть понятно, что нужно там тоже долго думать, там по странам выбирать и так далее, но это вот как бы у нас в дальнейшем. Вот. Что еще можно сделать? Можно взять и просто вот тоже, так, сейчас, минуточку, сейчас я вспомню. Ага, да, это вот по аннотациям отчетов у нас было сделано. Вот по тем же аннотациям отчетов можно как бы выстраивать как раз вот эти вот смысловые цепочки, да, вот даже не просто цепочками, а вот такими как бы, как кольца на деревьях, да, то есть просто по корреляциям. Вот, то есть и на полике, и у нас отброс до там дальше, самое, по падению индекса корреляции, вот они у нас расположены, ближайшие слова. Вот потом слова второго уровня, слова там третьего уровня, да.
Можно просто, что это число значит, что это?
Коэффициент корреляции Пирсона. Нуля до единицы. Чем ближе к единице, тем больше взаимосвязь статистического шока.
Я понимаю,
человек отдаляется.
Ну, потому что... Ну, нет, потому что это ближайшее, да. То есть, смотрите, по оценке, может быть, у него нет не очень большой коэффициент корреляции с инэколити, но у него хороший коэффициент корреляции с ниц, да, и он поэтому у нас раз на второй уровень от них происходит, и так далее. Вот они могут быть там левел сразу и с ниц, и с клуб там связан. Вот, то есть, может так. А вот, вообще очень интересно было посмотреть вообще выделение групп речевых маркеров. Но это вот часть работы у нас Даша сделала, Даша там сидишь, да, вот, не даст мне соврать. А, значит, наиболее часто употребляемые речевые маркеры выделены ключевая часть слова неизменяемая, вот для того, чтобы потом можно ее там поподробнее посчитать. И как бы у нас один корень слова дает там целый куст других слов, точнее наоборот, из вот, как бы, вот этого куста слов мы выделяем корень слова и дальше можем подсчитывать. А вот для меня было очень интересно взять, проанализировать только аннотации, вот это только аннотации отчетов, по отдельно взятой стране, допустим, Египет. Вот. Что бросилось в глаза? Но что там было 9 отчетов, это достаточно много, вот, и было очень интересно посмотреть, что здесь вот уровни неравенства рассматривались таким образом. То есть в других странах, наверняка, там другой принцип деления, здесь было вот так. То есть между социальными группами, там, прежде всего там, молодежь, потом между локальными сообществами и регионами Египта, и такие отраслевые отчеты, там две штучки, было, и особенно в процессе глобализации. И вот выражение какими речевыми маркерами, то есть длинное такое вот словосочетание было подобрано. Вообще вот для меня это было очень интересно. Особенно посмотрите вот это вот начало второго, вот это между локальными сообществами, имплицит local social contract. То есть, как бы, вот буквально на уровне речевых маркеров вводится новое такое содержание, то есть new social contract, то есть необходимое введение нового социального контракта, как отношение между руководством страны и гражданами и так далее. То есть для меня это было очень как бы интересно, да, то есть как бы тоже средства лекарства вот этого лечения неравенства между регионами. Сейчас participation in decision making, да, то есть сейчас social inequality between governors, regional dispatches. Вот, то есть как бы региональное неравенство и так далее. То есть здесь вот очень четко вот это вот все заметно. Вот. Ну и дальше очень интересно было расположить, вот этого я просто лично вручную вот раскидала, вот эти ключевые маркеры, да, по вот этим секторам, они группировались вот по специализированным отчетам, но в этих отчетах встречались вот такие слова-посредники, которые и в том типе отчетов, и в этом встречались. То есть это слова, вот допустим, между вот этим сектором неравенства социальных групп и отраслевой консультированием, суд очень знакомые слова сочетались. Social capital, human capital, ну и различные там виды индексов. Вот, между государственным управлением и отраслевым консультированием глобализация, civil society, liberalization of the economic regime. То есть это все весьма понятное для нашего слуха словосочетание, которые сами по себе несут некий такой факт социального действия. Вот, сектор государственного управления, неравенство социальных групп, local communities, но new social contracts. Здесь как бы тоже все понятно. Вот. Ну и дальше, собственно, буквально явление групп речевых маркеров ключевых как раз по вот этому вот, как бы развитию структуры. То есть неравенство, проявление неравенства, способы преодоления неравенства, ожидаемый результат преодоления, вы можете там потом отдельно все посмотреть, это все достаточно как бы интересно, да, то есть civil society, globalization, established free trade areas, modern democracy и так далее. Ну и индикаторы программы, понятно, которые использовались в качестве такого сугестивного такого эффекта. Вот, если вот эти вот аннотации прогнать через Ору Автомат, то вот получается такая структура, где у нас концепт неравенства вообще-то находится на периферии. То есть у нас ключевыми, центральными словами, которые держат весь абзац, что называется, ну, в данном случае всю аннотацию, это development, decentralization, local government. Вот. А вот неравенство, оно где-то немножечко на периферии. Вот. Ну и так вот поближе как-то. Вот. Ну и можно также посмотреть, как выстраиваются вот здесь Ора сама нам выстраивает вот эти вот семантические цепочки. Вот. Ну и видно, какие слова, собственно, нашу неполити окружают. Вот. Вот это другой тип, это как раз по branch globalization докладу было, аннотация к докладу. Ну, была там здесь уже неравенство оно такое более плотное, но все равно находится на периферии. То есть слово globalization, вот там вот вверху, тоже является центральным и таким прям весомым. Вот инеколики, вот оно желтеньким выделено, она у нас такая побогаче имеет окружение, но тем не менее все-таки там вот можно посмотреть inequality и cross countries, openness change inequality и так далее. Ну тоже достаточно как бы понятные ассоциации. Вот. Ну, в принципе, у меня так все. Так, я думаю, что это не сильно долго ваше время заняло. Ровно 20 минут, как обещал. Вот, теперь можно задавать вопросы, заводить дискуссию. Пожалуйста.
У меня вопрос по поводу статистического анализа текста. Есть концепт, я так понимаю, неравенства, есть концепт расслоения. В принципе, векторные модели, они должны быть, наверное, на одном месте стоять, потому что неравенство и расстояние – это одно и то же.
А вы знаете, может, конечно, но не стоят. Потому что практика и теория, она очень сильно отличается, понимаете? Пор и поверти, они тоже весьма разнесены в модели.
Так вопрос в том, может их получше объединить? Потому что значит, там не одно и то же?
Нет, коллеги, поверьте, на первом этапе лучше не объединить. Вот я тоже над этим думала, может быть, пор и поверки. Может быть, пор и поверки лучше объединить. Но потом я все-таки поняла, что как бы действительно у них, понимаете, они уже сами по себе и одинаковые, но у них буквально сильно разные, когда мы там посмотрим.
Вот,
Вот потому что пур это прежде всего относится к анализу локальных групп, а поверки это уже как государственная политика. Вот, то есть, может быть, мы потом дойдем, что вот нужно будет дать чем-то пренебречь, но мы пока очень вот, нам интересно посмотреть, как они группируются, потому что, понимаете, мы можем объединить все совсем, но в результате это могут сразу вот эти слои анализа сошли. Понятно?
Просто вот эти названия индексов, как бы неудивительно, что они получились очень числотные, потому что у них нет синонимов. А там такие слова, как коррупция, у него может быть по всему тексту какие-то слова взятки, вы их не объединяете, и получается, каждое слово в отдельности маленькое, ну, в смысле, я предполагаю, возможно, что если это просуммирует, то будет не такое отличие.
Нет, а там отличие как раз небольшое по частоте. Вот я как раз говорю, я взяла самые часто употребляемые слова, то есть они все названы. Да, во-первых, а что касается вот, коррупции и взятка, то во всяком случае вот в этих анализах, что я смотрела, там они не опускаются до таких вот низов, что в чем она там проявляется и так далее. То есть оно уже слово взятка один раз где-то всплыло, и зачем мы его будем тащить вот в эту большую. Поэтому я говорю, понимаете, здесь как бы вот в таком анализе очень опасно идти вот, чисто количественными подходами. Потому что мы должны четко понимать социальный смысл. То есть если у нас слова похожи, но разбегаются вот по интонациям на разные уровни анализа, то есть вот это вот слово у нас в описании там жизни бедной женщины в бедвинских селениях, а вот тут вот у нас это слово похожее, но оно уже на описании там, государственной политики, это вообще-то разные слова, вот пока во всяком случае не надо.
У меня еще вопрос по коэффициенту корреляции Пирсона. Вот, выборки брались просто по наличию этого слова в тексте, и потом сочетался коэффициент корреляции или как?
Нет, просто все аннотации, 369 аннотаций. Вот, и там вот, там, условно говоря, есть столько слов. И они вот такие вот достаточно как бы запомнили, мы брали, просто посмотрели. Нет, но здесь я тоже использовала самые там 300 наиболее самых употребляемых слов.
На следующий математический, между векторами да. Частот.
Да.
Я понял.
То есть, смотрите, всего по... Значит, я вам сейчас вот как бы вас ужасную цифрами. Значит, 369 отчетов, полная вообще подсчет всех частот всех слов, это 17 миллионов у нас получилось.
Я сам делал, похоже.
Да. Ну, отчет тогда справит. Вот, значит,
за... Коэффициент корреляции Пирсона использует немного другие методологии, типа текст-ранг, да, например, по взаимному влиянию слов. То есть коэффициент корреляции Пирсона выбросом таким, который обязательно будут, когда лекция достаточно разная.
Значит, да, нет. Во-первых, там используется частота слов. Да, у нас как бы частота, как сказать, шкала измерения интервальная. Мы спокойно там можем. Потому что это частота слова. Там от 0 слов до 100, 150, 200 слов и так далее. То есть я говорю, я взяла, отрезала вот 300 самых употребляемых слов. Вот всего их было 8000. То есть у нас вот топ слов вот это, он самый-самый максимально наполненный. Я просто смотрела ради интереса, выстраивается там какая-то структура или не выстраивается. Ну, она выстраивается. Вот, если вы хотите поговорить об устранении влияния третьего коэффициента, да, и поиске там частных корреляций, ну, это уже там другой тип работы, сильно геморройный, может, мы проделаем это.
Нет, немного про другое хотел.
Вы аннотации храните в базе?
Да, конечно.
А почему вы не используете поисковую систему? Когда вы коснетесь, ну, какую-нибудь корпоративного класса. Например, есть Omnified, ну, сейчас заменяем другую, по идее. Система читает PDF. Система умеет разбирать метаданные документа, то есть автора, там, дату и так далее. Кладет в соответствующие поля, если она настраивается. Может из текста разбирать информацию, если вы скажете, где ее выбирать, она тоже сразу автоматически положит порядок.
Не, это...
Количество документов, которые она может обрабатывать, сотни тысяч, не проблема. То есть вот 40 тысяч документов, ну, это нормальная баска.
Нет, тут
сам... Потом все это экспортируется, куда вам удобно.
Я как бы совершенно не против, но прежде чем как бы задавать, что искать, нужно знать, что искать. А у нас вот как бы...
Нет, поток документов разбирается на части, на составляющие элементы. Поля заполняются как бы автоматически. Вам нужно, вам один раз нужно настроить на типы документов, И дальше все это заполняется автоматически. Вам не нужно вручную это
бюро. А она бесплатная или платная?
Нет, вот это конкретно платное. Но есть
бесплатные. Ну, вопрос закрыт.
Есть другие бесплатные.
Ну, хорошо, если вам посоветуем, будем сейчас. Да,
можно? Ну, Люсина есть. Она тоже читает PDF. Это открытое сообщество.
Значит, еще раз. У нас исходная наша информация – это фотографии страниц с текстами.
Без текста.
Да, то есть PDF – это способ собрать вместе кучу фотографий. Вот реально, исходная информация.
Без текстового слоя.
Без текстового слоя.
Тогда вы вводите лучше.
Нет, мы пытаемся как можно распознать, а потом оказывается, что автор каждого отчета считает, что должен проявить эстетическое чувство, как он параграфы раскидает по странице. Самое трудное не распознать текст, а выстроить порядок. Нет устойчивого слова.
Тогда вы должны вводить распознавание, это делать тем самым цером, да?
Гениально, делаем. Проблема не распознать буквы. Проблема параграфы выстроить в том порядке, как это человек бы их выстроил. Программы не могут порядок параграфов на странице восстановить. Абзацы не могут расставить на странице. Да, то есть у нас получается, что вот программа не ловит, как идет строчка с предложением. Она перескакивает и схватает из другого абзаца.
Проблема даже не ввести данные, проблема распознать.
Проблема вот
эта. Ну, API вам не поможет?
Бесплатно нет пока.
Вот, и мало того, еще иногда у нас попадается, что какой-то отчет, допустим, вот все, английский, раз, на испанском или на французском. Вот, это тоже как бы автоматом не зашли.
Еще вопрос, морфологию вы как-то используете потом?
Ну, сейчас же.
Ну, нормализация есть, конечно.
Ну, да, нормализация есть.
А еще вопрос такой, эти документы, они вообще-то говорят про валу, это международное право.
А открытые тут?
Не, я понимаю, вот регистры вы потом привлекали.
Ну, сейчас пока он нам, в принципе, особо не нужен, потому что мы там социальными какими-то вещами озабочены. Потом, если увидим, что он нам нужен, может, привлечем.
И еще, наверное, знаете, вы из России, да, в университете? Вам нужно структурировать эти понятия.
Вы знаете, я очень много кого знаю в смежных областях, да, там на уровне, я не знаю, международное вот это политическое консультирование и так далее. Вот. И в принципе они как бы и юридическое в том числе консультируют, какой-то там экспертизу в судах производят и так далее. Но просто у них своя как бы фишка, свой угол рассмотрения текстового документа. Вот у нас просто социологические задачи поставлены, то есть там Катя, она даже больше какой-то теоретический обзор проводит, им это интересно. Вот мне теория, она не особо интересна, мне интересна эмпирическая часть, эмпирическая и методологическая. Соответственно,
ну, я спросил про юристов, потому что те, кто производит эти системы, то есть сколько, да, корпоративные, они говорят, что в группу надо привлекать специалистов разных.
Я все классно. Вот у нас социологи, математики, есть программисты. Пока.
Марина Витальевна, я вас хотела еще спросить, а вы, наверное, в будущем вы не хотите какие-то еще российские, может быть, какие-то отчеты там повести как сравнительный анализ, ну, посмотреть какие-то.
Вы этим займетесь? Я готова руководить. Не, серьезно, потому что всем хочется заняться, там и делать давно, сколько хочется заняться. Но рук не хватает, к сожалению. И вот мы как бы выезжаем, я честно говорю, на крайне заинтересованных студентов. Я всячески заинтересованных поддерживаю, вот, и они себе диплом сделают, и нам что-то интересное такое сделают. Ну, я не знаю, все обсуждаемо. То есть, ну, мы как бы за других работать не будем, но мы радостно всех презентируем. Все, коллеги. Ну, чудненько, спасибо всем большое.
Можно эту лекцию забрать?
Так, на каком? На русском собирайте.